Radio.
Hi, I'm Sarah and you're listening to Cradio. Today I'm joined by Managing Director and Co-Founder of Choices Media, Jonathan Doyle. Jonathan, thanks for joining me today.
Hey Sarah, thank you. Nice to be called a co-founder because often people don't realise that the smartest decision I ever made, marrying Karen many years ago, she's been a huge part of this journey, and most of what you know we do is very much contributed to by her.
Of course. Well, they say behind every great man is a greater woman, don't they?
Correct. And I think it's true in this case.
So I have with me here your new book, How to Get the Man of Your Dreams. Congratulations. This is your first book?
It's the first. Well, yeah, it is. It's the first sort of major book that I've done. It's a lot like climbing Everest. Everybody has a book in them. And I think everybody really has got, you know, stuff to share with the world, but getting it done is amazing. Like it takes ages just to get it written, and then I worked with some editors overseas, and then I had about 10 people here looking at it. So when you finally get boxes back from the printer in your hand, it's very cool. So yeah, it's been a long journey, but great to see it finally getting it in people's hands.
Well, it's great. It's a great read. So hopefully it won't be your last. Hopefully climbing Everest hasn't turned you off mountains for life.
No, I've got about, I said to somebody yesterday at a meeting, I said, I don't have gears. I don't sort of do nuance. I've got about, you know, a couple of hundred books left in me, I think. And we were just on the beach on the weekend and where I actually wrote this first one, and definitely got some new ones coming out. I want to do some stuff for Catholic teachers, and obviously some stuff for the guys, you know, given that I've worked with men for so long as well. So yes, indeed, there will be many more to come.
Well, yeah, you have been speaking to men and women for a number of years, and your background is in boys' education. So what inspired you to have this first book particularly for the women?
That's an awesome question. I've done live seminars now to just over a quarter of a million people over the last sort of 7 or 8 years, and in many ways I've been a boys specialist, specialising in masculinity and some of the big issues for boys, but at the same time I've been doing a lot of co-ed seminars, a lot of all-girls seminars. And I think, honestly, I tried to write the boys' book first, and I had written lots of it, and it just wasn't quite where I wanted to be. I wasn't clear enough what I was trying to do. And then probably about 18 months ago, 12 months ago, really, we were having a family holiday, and I just said, right, I can't just keep putting this off. So while Karen and the kids are all asleep at the coast house, I got up every day at sort of 3:30, 4 a.m., and I started to write the girls' book. The reason I wrote it was, you know, I just kept coming across so many girls who would come up in the breaks in the seminars and tell me the most incredible stories. And how do I say this nicely? People have a kind of stereotype, a kind of belief that girls making poor decisions are coming from really bad backgrounds and they've had a family breakdown and all sorts of stuff. But what I was finding is it was right across the board. It was girls from elite schools. It just struck me that no matter who they were, that there just seemed to be the ability to consistently make some poor choices. And I felt quite emotional about it. I heard some unbelievable things, and it just was the right time. And so I got up and I did it. So stay tuned. The boys' book's coming, but I think the girls' book was just there because I was just hearing so many amazing stories.
In the book, you talk about this relatively recent phenomenon of the man boy, so the Peter Pan type who prefers to stay home playing video games rather than building his character. And you make this distinction, no, we can't date these guys in the hope that we might change them, but that there is a role that women ought to play in educating these young men. Could you elaborate a bit more on that distinction?
Yeah. Look, Karen and I have a favourite quote from John Paul, and we spoke at a conference actually just last weekend with a couple of hundred men where she shared it again. And he famously said, the direct quote was, human life is essentially co-educative, and it depends at every moment of history for its poise, dignity and balance on who she will be for him and on who he will be for her. So you think about that quote, and you know, people listening to the interview, they can probably play it back. He's arguing that we essentially educate each other about what it is to be human. And when a man is fully living in the fullness of who he is, he will help a woman understand who she is, and she will do the same for him. this kind of revelation of the truth of who we are as persons happening in the dynamic of relationship. So to answer your question, look, I intuitively think it's dangerous to try and change somebody in a relationship. It's asking for trouble, and I said that in an interview again recently, that if you specifically try to change somebody, you're probably communicating to them, look, there's something wrong with you, and you need to be different here. And look, Karen and I have been married 12 years, and you know, like a lot of couples, we don't have any problem encouraging each other with directions for growth. But I just think, you know, so many girls are putting up with really poor behaviour and telling themselves that he'll change. But honestly, I don't see it working as a strategy.
Sort of just on that, you really emphasise the quote, we esteem but lightly what we gain too easily. And you sort of draw out the point that men in relationships, they really need to be challenged. They really need to work. Is there a point where we are expecting too much?
There's been a whole milieu, I think, of media and stuff, I think, over the last probably 10, 15 years, that it idealizes relationships. I guess what I'm getting at is, I said at the conference on the weekend, that this culture doesn't know what to do with men. It doesn't know what to do with them. It wants them to be soft, gentle, and feminine. At the same time, they're supposed to be alpha males. They're supposed to be making a lot of money. There's no consistent cultural message about, you know, what it means to be a fine man. But still, look, I think it's reasonable, Sarah, for girls to have a reasonable expectation, like to want a decent man, to want to be in a relationship with a fine young man. In terms of expectations, I think to over-idealise, to expect a guy to be perfect is problematic. He's human. And when we do relationship seminars, we say, you know, to anybody in the room, you're not perfect. And to think you're going to find some absolutely perfect person is another recipe for disaster. But what we do say is you've got to look at the big ticket things. If a guy has problems with big issues such as dependability and faithfulness, substance abuse, internet and pornography addictions, you're obviously, those are red flags. And the hope that they'll change someday, you have to let him go away, and he's got to decide if he wants to work on that stuff. And if he does, that's fantastic. If he doesn't, then, you know, girls, I think, need to be strong enough to move on and to be patient.
Now, feeding into this book, you've obviously got a lot of experience working with young men and women. You share the stories of some of these people that you've encountered. Now, you talk about how a lot of the poor relationship decisions will, on the woman's part, stem from her fear of ending up alone and just this poor sense of self-worth. And you spend a lot of time convincing women that there are good men out there and that they do deserve better. But for those women, I guess, who have never witnessed a healthy relationship, sadly, they're out there, who don't have a relationship with their father, who may not even know what a healthy relationship looks like. Now, can you help these women come to appreciate what is possible by speaking to them, or do you find it's something that really needs to be seen and experienced?
I mean, you've raised a whole lot of stuff in the question. We often talk about the work of somebody like Professor Patrick Fagan, who is a bit of an expert on sort of the father-son stuff and father-daughter stuff, sorry, and he sort of, the theory is that a father sets the benchmark of expectation. So if a girl has a committed father who validates her worth in non-sexual ways, then she develops a kind of a platform, a kind of sense that she's good in who she is, and she expects that treatment out there from young men she meets. Now, we have, you know, some very significant issues with relationship breakdown, and, you know, I often say that in 1910 the divorce rate was 9%. It's currently around about 45%, depending on where you look. So a lot of girls are going to come into their teens and 20s with some deep existential pain around their sense of self-worth stemming from that relationship. What I can say in this environment is that, look, after all these years, I think the most powerful thing is for a young woman to encounter a genuine relationship with God as father. What we do with girls these days is we just try to do this girl power, respect yourself stuff. It's like, say why? What's your basis for self-respect? In a culture that's sort of a secular materialist culture, you don't have a basis for self-respect. You only have a basis for self-respect when you are created, you know, in the image and likeness of God. So the work for young people is to deepen in that relationship and allow God over time to speak deeply into that, into any wounding or pain, and for them to find their true sense of self-worth and identity in Him. I want to be very honest, there is complexity in the world. I can't give a simple one, you know, recipe that do X and X will happen. We've had all had different journeys, but I think, you know, in summary, if girls allow God as Father to speak to them over time, then that's something. Vulnerability and some of that possible neediness will be less intense.
Mm. I guess part of those complexities in our current culture, you touch on this in the book as well. It's we don't understand what love is. We think of love as a feeling, and today emotions are taking precedence in a lot of our decision making processes, unfortunately. And I'm sure you've met these girls. I know I've met some of them who might be in a really messy, abusive relationship even. But when you speak to them, it's just, oh, but I love him. I can't choose who I love. I love him. I guess, how do you speak to those girls where they're at, when emotions are sort of, you know, overriding their ability to be able to make healthy decisions?
Brilliant question. You've come to the core of one of our big cultural problems is that we have a huge cultural problem with love, and when we do seminars, we spend a lot of time working on this. And the real revelation for Karen and I was doing the study at the John Paul II Institute, and we tell a story, and I think it's in the book, of sitting in a lecture room one day, and we had a guy called Monsignor Livio Molina, who's one of the best moral theologians in the world, and he was taking us through some stuff on love, and he wrote up on this whiteboard this phenomenal definition that's I've shared now with tens of thousands of people, which is simply this: to love is to will the good of the other. A Catholic understanding of love will situate it, in the Latin we say voluntus, in the ability to choose concrete actions that will the good of another person. Now, that doesn't mean love doesn't have an affective, emotional component. Of course it does. There's John Paul II has this funny moment where he, in the way that he can be indirectly humorous, where he says, the reasons that we make the choices we do, everybody listening to this, you've all at some point fallen in love with somebody or had this strong feeling of attraction, and John Paul raised the question, why does this happen? Why do we find X person attractive? And he says, we don't know. The answers remain largely unknown. We don't know the mystery of why we just find a particular person so captivating. And the next step is, that's part one. This, and I say to people in seminars, enjoy every moment of that when you meet somebody and you come alive. And this incredible story where she wouldn't date me for 3 years, and I would just be in her presence and want to be with her. And then over time, in our rich Catholic understanding, you will be faced with choices to act in ways that are different to how you feel. So for a girl with a boyfriend who is abusive and she's like, but I love him, that's highly problematic. Like, abuse is abuse. You can't be in a relationship like that. And the risk is the stories we tell ourselves, that so many of us will tell ourselves all kinds of stories to hold on to what we're trying to hold on to. So genuine human love is challenging, it is difficult, and it requires grace. For me to love my 3 children who never sleep and my amazing wife requires grace, sacraments. It's a serious business. Isn't that funny to call love that? But genuine love requires the intellect, reason, and emotions, and that's what we're trying to do in the book and in the seminars, is just to upskill people a bit and go, it's not just about how you feel.
Toward the end of the book, because you basically spend the first couple of sections of the book establishing the premise, establishing the argument and what needs to change, and toward the end you offer 8 practical steps on sort of how to change this negative mindset that's feeding into these negative relationships. One of the things you talk about is the importance of friendship and community. Obviously, you've spent a lot of time in schools. I haven't really been there since I graduated, but I know from my experience in high schools, there tends to be this really toxic environment where the girls are feeding each other's insecurities and the boys are getting sucked into this pack mentality. So obviously, it's really difficult for young people who want to make good decisions, who want to make a change and sort of stand up against the tide. they can be really isolated. So I suppose, what is it that we can do as teachers, as youth ministers, family members, parents? What can we do to empower these people to be able to do that?
We're in stage one of a cultural rebuild. You know, we don't get to choose when we're born. We don't get to choose what we're asked to do in the life of the church. And we're being asked to do something in the new evangelization. That's what Cradio is about. And honestly, it's what drives everything we do. You've got to be optimistic. Imperial Rome was profoundly impacted by the witness of marriage and family. People don't realize this, that, you know, in Imperial Rome, you could divorce your wife on the spot, you could, you know, abortion and infanticide was common, and it was actually the witness of Christian relationships and marriages that really began to shift things. And people think that's crazy, that didn't happen. But study the history closely, the witness of great marriages, relationships have a profound impact. So if you're working in schools, if you're working in parishes, it may take 300 or 400 years, and terrible things are going to happen before that happens. The culture of life will flourish. John Paul talks about a new springtime. He's not trying to amuse himself and the world. He's serious. You know, I said on the weekend in this lecture, I said, look, he knew something we didn't. And what you have to do is be incredibly responsible. You get life, and you need to think about it carefully and make excellent choices, even if they're difficult. And that will be in the field of relationships. Young women needing the courage to end a relationship, or having the great courage to be alone until they find somebody worthy of them. So I'm an optimist, Sarah. I actually think things are going to get a little bit worse before they get better. Mm-hmm. But we need to hold on tight. Look, John Paul II gave us a lot, and we're not even scratching the surface of what he gave us. So, you know, there's plenty of good stuff to come. And look, even recently, you know, people like, you know, Kevin Andrews, the opposition minister, who's just written a phenomenal book on marriage, very high-level scholarship. So there's stuff still happening. We're going to see it turn around. Maybe not tomorrow, but it's happening.
I think I agree with you. I think that new springtime is coming, and thank God we have the gift of Blessed JP2 and the Theology of the Body, and we have people like you who are out there helping young people connect the dots. Thanks for catching up with me today, Jonathan. I know you're a very busy man. There's a lot going on, so it's been really great talking to you.
And I'm not busy. I just sit around all the time, write the occasional book.
So for those listening, Jonathan's book, How to Get the Man of Your Dreams, is now available at www.choices.com.au. It's a must read, so pick it up for sisters, daughters, friends, everyone. And of course, you can find Jonathan on Facebook and Twitter. Check the Choices site or Cradio's website, cradio.org.au, for that information.
Cradio.org.au.